Well, it's really good to be back in the book of Samuel after a couple weeks break. We had a combined service with the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and then we had Passover last week. A lot of people had their Seders. We had something a little different here, but it's really good to be back in Samuel. As we get to chapter 4 in Samuel, the starring role changes. In chapters 1, 2, and 3 of Samuel, Samuel has the starring role. He is mentioned 26 times in the first three chapters, but the Ark of the Covenant is only mentioned once. But when you get to chapter 4, 5, and 6, Samuel is only mentioned one time. And the Ark of the Covenant is mentioned 37 times. The star of the show in chapters 4, 5, and 6 is the Ark of the Covenant. Now, I know probably every one of you know what the Ark of the Covenant is, but just to make sure, we're going to look at some pictures and refresh our memory. I went on the internet to find some images, and I found three images are all a bit different. This is a typical understanding of what the Ark of the Covenant looked like. It is made of two parts. It's a box of wood covered with gold on the outside and on the inside. And then you have a lid of solid gold with two cherubim, these two angelic beings. And it's a hammered out gold, and their wingtips are touching over the top. God instructed that there need to be two staves to carry the ark with in the side, and they have to be in these two loops, two on each end. And so maybe this is what it looked like. This is a very ornate version of the ark. In fact, this one even has windows in it, which is a little bizarre. This is the model of the ark that was made for the Indiana Jones film. But again, you can see it's gold. You've got the two cherubim, and you have the lid. You've got the staves. Now here, the staves are running from left to right instead of from front to back, as the previous picture. According to most Jewish sources, this is incorrect. But the staves would have run through this way at 90 degrees to what they have here. But who knows? And then here's a computer-generated image of the ark. Again, a little bit different. And you've got the box, remember, made of wood. Gold-plated on the outside and the inside. You've got the loops, the rings, four of them for the two staves. Then you have a solid gold lid and two cherubim mounted on top, hammered out of one solid piece of gold. And this up here is called the mercy seat. Now, when you read the description that God gives us in the Torah of how the ark is to be built, you find something kind of unusual. You know, in the outer court of the tabernacle, you had two pieces of furniture. You had the bronze altar, and then you had the bronze laver. And then when you go into the holy place, you have two pieces of furniture, one on the left, one on the right. You've got the golden menorah, and then you've got the golden table of showbread. Now, there's also this golden incense altar, which is a cubit by a cubit wide, and it's small. But then when you go into the Holy of Holies, how many pieces do you have? Just one, right? Well, if you say one, you're correct. But if you say two, you're also correct. Because when God gives the description for the ark, he does it in a very unusual way. You'll find the description in Exodus 25. And here's what is unusual about it. In Exodus 25, we'll start reading in verse 10. God is instructing Moses, says, "They shall construct an ark of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits long, and 1.5 cubits wide, and 1.5 cubits high. You shall overlay it with pure gold inside and out, and you shall overlay it, and you shall make a gold molding around it." This is for the lid to seat in, so the lid can't slide off. There's a molding around the top. "You shall cast four gold rings for it and fasten them on its 4 feet, and 2 rings shall be on one side of it, and 2 rings on the other side of it. You shall make poles of acacia wood and overlay them with gold. You shall put the poles into the rings on the sides of the ark to carry the ark with them. The poles shall remain in the rings of the ark and shall not be removed from it. You shall put into the ark the testimony which I shall give you." The two stone tablets containing the 10 words, the 10 commandments, were put into this box. No mention of a lid, right? The next verse then says, you shall make a mercy seat of pure gold. Now, here's the thing. It's unusual, and it's very easy to miss. He treats the lid with a mercy seat on it as a separate thing. He starts it off as if he's saying, now, there's a whole completely different thing. Here's the ark. I've described the box. Okay, that's done. Now, here's something else I want you to make. He didn't just give the description of all of it together. He didn't say, I want you to make a box with a lid on it. Now, the box has this, the lid has that, and the rings go here, and the cherubim. He didn't do that. He treats it as if it's two completely separate constructions. Okay? It's very important to catch this. Verse 17, you shall make a mercy seat of pure gold, 2.5 cubits long and 1.5 cubits wide. You shall make 2 cherubim of gold and make them of hammered work at the 2 ends of the mercy seat. Make 1 cherub at one end and 1 cherub at the other. You shall make the cherubim of 1 piece with the mercy seat and its 2 ends. The cherubim shall have their wings spread upward, covering the mercy seat with their wings and facing one another. The faces of the cherubim are to be turned toward the mercy seat. You shall put the mercy seat on top of the ark, and in the ark you shall put the testimony which I will give to you. Again, there's the reference to the testimony, and now we see the ark mentioned again. There I will meet with you, and from above the mercy seat, from between the 2 cherubim which are upon the ark of the testimony, I will speak to you about all that I will give you in commandment to the sons of Israel. And in this image you can see there's this like ball of light hovering above the wings of the cherubim. This is the Shekinah glory, the spiritual light that illuminated the Holy of Holies. But do you see how God described this as 2 separate constructions? And then he says, now this is their relationship. Now, if you can picture yourself walking into the tabernacle, you know, walking into the courtyard, you see the altar of bronze, and then beyond that, a few steps on further, you see the laver. So they're in line, one directly in front of the other. If you go into the tabernacle, you've got 2 pieces, one to the left, one to the right. But when you go into the Holy of Holies, you have 2 pieces, one directly above the other, and they're actually touching. It's a very important concept God has given us. And when we go through our Torah portion again, we'll give more attention to this. Here's what I want you to see from this, though. We're going to go to the end of our story, and near the end of it, because there's a very important principle here that I don't want us to miss. If you go to Samuel chapter 6, this is after the battle that the Israelites left are lost, and the Philistines have stolen the ark. They've taken it, put it in the temple of Dagon. Dagon falls on his face. The second time he falls on his face, his head and his palms are cut off. They break off. And then finally, there are these plagues, and it's a big mess. And finally, they decide, we've got to get this ark out of here. They put it on the cart. They send it on its way. The cows take it right to Beth Shemesh, to the field of Joshua. And I want to pick it up there. If we go to chapter 6, and we will pick it up, verse 19. And it says, and he, referring to God, smote some of the men of Beth Shemesh because they peered into the ark of Adonai. They took the lid off and they looked in. They took the lid off. They separated these 2 pieces that were to remain together. They separated them and they looked in. He struck among them 70 men. 50,000 men. A very odd way to put things. He doesn't say 50,000, 70 men. He says he struck 70 men, 50,000 men. And these were Levites. They should have known how to handle the ark. What does it mean, 70 men and 50,000 men? We're not really sure whether we should just add the numbers together. We don't know if it meant he struck 70 men right then who were in that field, and then later a plague spread and killed 50,000 people additionally. We're not quite sure. But more people died here at Beth Shemesh for taking the lid off the ark and looking into it. More people died here than in both of the battles against the Philistines. God killed more Israelites here than what the Philistines killed in battle. And it says, and the people of Beth Shemesh said, who can possibly stand before Adonai, this holy God? To whom can the ark ascend from among us? And what do? They do the same thing the Philistines did. Send it away. But isn't that incredible? It's just absolutely amazing to me. Send it away. Here's what I think the real error is. And I think it's going to be best to be illustrated by this overhead that I put together called Anatomy of God's Throne, or People Live on It. I want us to start with the bottom of the ark. We know that the mercy seat, from our description here, this is the place where God's Shekinah glory rests. This is his throne. This is his seat of mercy. But in Psalm 89:14, David tells us righteousness and justice are the foundation of your throne. Now, what's inside the box, the foundation for the mercy seat? God's law, God's commandments, God's do's and don'ts. This is how you live. They are rigid, they are on rock, they are in the box. So the foundation of God's throne is righteousness and justice. And that is what is represented by God's commandments, his laws that he gives us. And that is in the box. That's the foundation for the lid. You understand what I'm saying? But then what do the scriptures tell us about the lid? You know, in Hebrews chapter 4, the writer, throughout Hebrews, gives us information about the tabernacle, the Holy of Holies, the Ark of the Covenant, and how Yeshua is our high priest who's opened a way by his own blood to come into God's presence. You know, the curtain has been torn, we're told in Matthew, and the way is opened. And what does he tell us as he discusses Yeshua's high priesthood? He tells us, therefore, let us draw near with confidence to the throne of what? Justice? Throne of righteousness? Throne of judgment? No. Throne of grace. So that we may receive what? Mercy. And find grace to help in time of need. It's extremely important. The lid on top is the throne of grace. The box that supports it, the foundation of God's throne, is righteousness and justice. And these two must always be kept together. But you know what? I have met individuals. I have been one of these. I've been both of these individuals. I have met congregations, churches, messianic, otherwise, that either they want the box without the lid, or they want the lid without the box. When you take the lid off and you begin to behold God's laws without mercy, without grace, without the presence of God with you, it is a deadly thing. It is a killer. Because the letter of the law will kill. I've watched brother destroy brother and sister destroy sister. I've seen families split. I've seen congregations split. I've seen them condemn one another and the world and everybody else because they've got a box that resembles a coffin more than an Ark of the Covenant. And they look into this box without the throne of God's mercy above it. And it becomes a deadly thing, just like at Beth Shemesh. On the other hand, I know people and individuals, they want the mercy seat. They want the lid. They don't have much use for God's righteousness. They don't have much use for God's laws, for his Torah, for his commandments. It's all mercy and grace, 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 grace. But what kind of seat is it that doesn't have a foundation under it? It's built on sand. And it will sink. And it will shift. And the thing is, God's presence will not be there. You must have them together at all times. And these cherubim are looking down. And they are viewing God's standard of righteousness, his commandments. But they're viewing them through a place of mercy where the blood is sprinkled. We must have both of these. They must be in proper relationship to each other. You see, everything from the box down is all very earthy. It's made up of what? Wood. It's made up of rock, because that's what the commandments are engraved on. And gold. But everything above is made up of what? Just gold. One piece of gold, hammered out. There's nothing, there are no mixed materials here. It's a place of unity. Because everything from the lid up represents the spiritual realm. Everything from the lid down represents the physical. This is the world of separation. I'm here and you're there and people are over there and other people can't see and everything's divided. We live in this multi-dimensional world where everything's kind of separate. But God wants to make us one. He wants to operate as one. Not out of conformity, not out of being clones, but by being separate individual members of one body. And by separate, I mean by having their individual identities, but working and functioning together in love, functioning by God's Spirit as a unit. That's what God wants. The spiritual realm is called the realm of unity, the realm of oneness, where all is one. And there's a day coming, Zechariah tells us, it says, in that day God will be king over all the earth, and God will be one and his name one. And as you read the descriptions of the new heavens and new earth, you find everything is oneness. The spiritual and the physical realms are melded together to become one thing. It's an amazing study. I wish we had time to look into it tonight, but we don't. But these must stay together in our lives. Is God gracious and merciful? Absolutely. But he has a standard of righteousness that he wants us to adhere to so we can be holy as he is holy. Does God have a standard of righteousness? Does he have laws that tell us how to live, that tell us black from white and right from wrong and light from dark? Absolutely. But he views us, and we are to view one another through mercy, through grace. To see how they fit together? Which one is higher and which is lower? Not that one's more important than the other. For one, you cannot have the throne without a foundation. But this foundation without God's throne above it, where you have living creatures, without that throne above it, it's a coffin with four pallbearers on it. And it's a deadly thing. Do you understand the picture here? All right. When these are together, the Ark of the Covenant always represents God's presence in the world. Where you see the Ark of God, that is God's presence going. The Ark of the Covenant, when you hear Ark of the Covenant, this object, always think God's presence in the world. And God does not appear in the world apart from his righteousness or apart from his grace and mercy. They always go together. These two things, these two natures are one. You know, throughout the scriptures, we see two names for God. We see Elohim. That's the name that's used most often. And then we see Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. That's how his name is spelled in Hebrew. We don't know how it's pronounced. This holy name, his unique four-letter name. And the sages tell us where you see the word Elohim used, it refers to God's justice. And when you see Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh used, it refers to his mercy and grace. Yet are we talking about two gods here? No, same God. Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh is Elohim and vice versa. It's the same person. Did I say vice versa? Vice versa. That's what it is. Vice versa. And so we have to understand that this is how things are done. Do we get the picture here? So we're ready to start our study. Back to chapter 4 now. Back to chapter 4. You remember there's been Eli, the high priest. He has these two wicked sons, Hophni and Phinehas. They're just as bad as bad can be. I mean, we've talked about preacher kids before, but these are the worst of the worst. And the Philistines come and attack. And so Israel goes out to fight them. And we find out there in verse 2 that 4,000 Israelites died. And they're thinking, what's up? What's with this? Aren't we in covenant with relationship with God? Hasn't he promised us his protection? Aren't we his people and he's our God? And this is Shiloh, for Pete's sake. This is where his presence dwells. This is where the tabernacle is. What's going on here? And so some, you know, it never occurred to them to pray. You don't see one word of prayer here. But what do they say? Verse 3. Let us take with us from Shiloh the Ark of the Covenant of Adonai, that he may come in our midst and save us from the hands of our enemies. So the people sent to Shiloh and carried from there the Ark of the Covenant of Adonai, Master of Legions, who dwells atop the cherubim. It's almost as if they're using this long title just to remind God, you know, you're on our side, right? And you're powerful, right? You're going to win this, right? I mean, it's almost as if that's what they're doing. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there along with the Ark of the Covenant of God. So they bring it to the camp, and it says, and all Israel sounded a great shofar blast, and the ground shook. Verse 6, the Philistines heard the sound of the blast. And they said, what is the sound of this great blast in the camp of the Hebrews? And they became aware that the Ark of Adonai had come to the camp. The Philistines were afraid. You see, I imagine that the Israelites are thinking, you know, back in Joshua chapter 6, God commands Joshua to take the Ark of the Covenant, the priest, or to go around at the walls of Jericho. They do this day after day until finally on the last day, they blow the shofar and they all yell and the walls came tumbling down. Well, let's get this Ark of the Covenant out here. Let's show these Philistines who's boss. So they bring the Ark out, and this time 30,000 Israelites die. Hophni and Phinehas are killed, and the Ark of the Covenant is stolen by the Philistines. There's an important lesson here I want you to see. The Israelites were using the Ark of the Covenant as if it was God's leash. Well, if you take the Ark, God's got to come too. They treated the Ark like it was God in a box. Let's take a box of God out there on that battlefield. We'll whoop them. And they took a box of God out there and they lost the box and 30,000 of them died. And we tend to do the same thing. We rely upon some book or some speaker or some program or some seminar or some church or whatever. Oh, you got to do this. This will fix the problem. It's a box of God. And this, you just apply this, rub it on and drink it in and it would be great. And it just doesn't work. God does not wear a leash. Don't treat the holy things of God like a leash. Don't treat the Bible like a leash. Don't hold God hostage to the holy things of God. You don't own Him. He doesn't obey you. He owns you. You obey Him. And you know, if the people of this day had been truly following the Torah, the Philistines would not even have attacked. Because God promises in His Torah, if you stay in My word, if you obey My commandments, if you keep My laws, I'll put protection around you. And when there are times for battle, they'll flee from you. One of you will chase 100 of them. I mean, it'll just be a pushover. But we see here that God's consistent in this. The side that feared God won. I see no fear of God here with these Israelites, but it says the Philistines were afraid, and they won the battle. I rather have one person on my side who truly fears God than to have 100 who trust in God's power. Because all these Israelites, they were pumped. They were blowing shofars, and they're yelling, and you know, the ground is shaking. Here's the ark. They had all kinds of faith in God's power, but it doesn't seem to be like there was one among them that had any fear of God. I'll take the one man who fears God on my side. You can have the 100 you don't. You can have the 100 who claim His power and they shout His power and all that. I want the one person who truly fears God and has an awe and respect for Him. That's the one man I want standing by me. You can have all the rest. Because a side that fears God is a side that wins, even if they're Philistines. Well, 30,000 die, Hophni and Phinehas die, and there's this one Benjamite man down in verse 12. And the sages tell us that that is actually Saul, the one who will become king. We don't know, just a tradition. Might be, might not be. But he runs to tell Eli, and when Eli hears that the ark has been taken, he falls over backwards, breaks his neck, and dies. Now a little bit later, we're going to find something else falling over, breaking its neck. What is that? That's the god Dagon, the idol of Dagon. Well, let's see what's happening with the Philistines. They've won this battle. Let's go to chapter 5. Chapter 5, verse 1. The Philistines had taken the Ark of God and brought it from Ebenezer, which means Rock of Help. It's kind of odd that they have this battle at the Rock of Help, but God didn't help. But anyways, they took it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Ashdod is right on the Mediterranean coast. It's where the Gaza Strip is now. And it's kind of interesting that the Philistines lived there then along the coast, and the Palestinians, which is the exact same word, Philistine. Remember, in Hebrew, there's no vowels. It's P-L-S-T-N, and you have Palestine, P-L-S-T-N again. Same thing. Still living in the Gaza Strip in the same area. The Philistines took the Ark of God, brought it to the house of Dagon, placing it next to Dagon. Dagon was some kind of a fish god. Apparently he had like the body of a fish, we think, and then maybe the head of a man and like hands, or little hands sticking out the sides somehow. And so they worshiped Dagon. This is the same people in the same area where back in Judges, I think it's Judges, is it around chapter 16? I can't remember. Can't remember the chapter number. But this is where they took Samson. Remember after they captured Samson? And they brought him to the house, and all the people were saying, our god Dagon has conquered this hero of Israel. And there's Samson, who's blind, you know, but his hair has grown back out now. And he pulls the pillars in, and the whole house collapses, and everyone in it dies. Well, apparently they didn't learn much from that lesson. But now they've captured the ark. They took the ark and brought it to the house of Dagon, placing it next to Dagon. Now, what they're looking at here is that in ancient times, when two armies fought, it wasn't just the skill of the armies that was at stake. They figured the one with the strongest, the mightiest god is the army that will win. So it's not just a battle between two armies, it's a battle between two gods. So here's the god of Israel, and here's Dagon, the god of the Philistines. And the Philistines won. Therefore, Dagon must be stronger and greater than the god of Israel. So they take the Ark of the Covenant as a trophy, and they put it beside their god Dagon. It's like, okay, come on along, God of Israel. We're going to put you right here, and you can now work for Dagon. He's taken you captive. You're his servant now. That's how they thought. That's why they put the Ark in their temple, right next to Dagon. Because of all the gods and all the armies they've conquered, this is their big one. They actually have the Ark of the Covenant. Because they knew the stories about Israel coming out of Egypt and the building of the Ark. And they knew all these stories. We beat them. Our God is greater than theirs. It says there that in verse 3, the Ashdodites arose early the next day, and behold, Dagon had fallen upon its face to the ground before the Ark of Adonai. Now, this is what's so weird. If Dagon is standing here and the Ark is sitting right here and he falls on his face, he also had to turn to be in front of, facing the Ark of the Covenant. So what does a sane person do? They start to think, maybe the God of Israelites really is greater. Maybe we're worshiping the wrong God. That's what a sane person does. But you know what? Religion can make you mentally ill. I really believe it. Because look what they do, verse 4. They arose early the next morning, and again, you know, they're standing back up. Again, Dagon had fallen upon its face to the ground before the Ark of Adonai, and Dagon's head and the two palms of its hands were severed, lying upon the threshold. Now, after this happening twice, and the second time his head and his hands are gone, that means his brains and his power had been decapitated. They'd been gone, cut off. At that point, a sane person says, you know what? I'm shifting religions. I'm converting. I'm going to start worshiping the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of Israel. Maybe the Israelites were just messed up, and their God allowed them to lose because they weren't living right. I'm worshiping this God because obviously this God I used to worship has now bowed down to him twice, and this God of Israel has broken off his head and hands. I'm worshiping the God of Israel. Isn't that what a sane person does? But religion, I really believe, can make you mentally ill. When you cling to a religion, because that's the religion you were born into, and you live with and grew up with, and you hang on to it no matter what, there's something wrong with you. Because look what they do. Dagon's head and his two palms of his hands were severed upon the threshold. It was sitting upon the threshold. That's where they were. Only Dagon, in other words, the word body is not there in Hebrew. It says only Dagon remained to him. It's just his body is all that's left. Look what it says, verse 5. This is why the priest of Dagon and all of those who come to the house of Dagon do not tread upon the threshold of Dagon and Ashdod to this day. These people were not all there upstairs. Twice, the God of Israel has toppled Dagon. Second time, his head and hands are cut off, and they're sitting right on the threshold, as if Dagon is going there and saying, "Don't come in! Don't come in! This is not." You know, it's almost like he's there warning them. I give up, uncle. I lose. That's the real guy. So what do? They now treat the threshold of honor, because that's where Dagon's head and hands were, and they step over it. They would leap over it. They wouldn't want to step on where their God's head and hands had been sitting. This God who had lost twice, thrown to the ground in front of the Ark of the Covenant. This is insanity. And yet you and I have met a lot of insane people. We have met people who were born into a denomination or religion, and they will refuse till their dying day to give it up for a superior body of truth. Now, most of you that I know here, you weren't born into Messianic Judaism. You made your way here from some other place, because you're a truth seeker. But that's the difference between the person who's merely religious and the one who's seeking truth. A real truth seeker will go to the ends of the earth to find God and to be what God wants him to be, no matter what that looks like, no matter what that costs. But there are other people who are like this. They're mentally ill, spiritually ill. Because truth can stare them in the face. It's like, no, I haven't heard that before. If I haven't heard it before, it can't be true, because I've heard everything that's true, right? Have you ever heard people say, well, I've never heard that before, as if that's a reason not to believe it? As if that automatically makes it untrue? I mean, somehow in my 56 years of life, I saw this feeling there's more I haven't heard than have. I just have a feeling in the whole universe, there are more things I haven't heard than I have heard. So, and a lot of what I've heard isn't true. So if I haven't heard it, maybe that is true. But God has given us a book, which is a lamp to our feet, a light to our path. You know, that goes back to our little overhead here. Remember the base, and you have the seat above it? What does David say about the Torah? It says, thy word is a lamp to my feet, a light to my path. It's light here in the physical world, but how to walk. But what is up here? The holy, spiritual, Shekinah light of God, which is only in the Holy of Holies, shines only in the Holy of Holies, a spiritual light. You see again how both are a source of light, but one is low into this world, how to walk in this world. But there's this unseen light that should dwell in our Holy of Holies as well. There should be a light that goes on inside of us. And somehow we recognize spiritual reality when we contact it. So anyways, little side note there. Now, I need to make a little disclaimer. You know, there are other people who are mentally ill the other way. If for them, it's the religion of the month club. And they're hopping from one thing to the next. I mean, I know one person who passed through our doors here a few years ago. He went from being basically a criminal to being a Baptist to being, and he went through a few things between that, to being a Messianic Jew. And then he completely converted to Judaism. And I think Islam is probably next on the list, and probably Buddhism and Hinduism. And just in a period of just a very few short years, he went through all these variations, and ones in between. Just boom, 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 boom. It's like, wonder what he is now. And that is not stability either. We should be like people who are drawn to the light, and we keep moving towards it regardless of the cost. That's what we should be. People move towards truth, no matter what it is. So what does God do? he starts putting the pressure on these folks. Now, it's kind of interesting. After he refers to the palms of Dagon's hands, we see God's hand mentioned seven times after this. Perfection. Seven is the number of perfection, completeness. And if you count, God's hand is referred to seven times. For example, in verse 6, it says, "The hand of Adonai then became heavy against the Ashdodites, and he devastated them. He struck them, Ashdod and the surrounding areas, with hemorrhoids." And that's what the word is. If you have a Hebrew Bible, if you look over on the right, you'll see a Hebrew word in brackets. The word to the right of that is the actual word, ba'afalim, which means hemorrhoids. And in the bracket, they put a more polite term. And they do this consistently. And they make a note, this is what's written, but this is what we read. Well, you know, I'm just using the word as it is. Because there's an important spiritual lesson here. He struck the people with two things, hemorrhoids and mice. Hemorrhoids and mice. And so in Ashdod, they figured enough of this. Let's get rid of the ark. So they send it to Gath, down there in verse 8. Well, they get also a double portion of hemorrhoids and mice. So they figure, let's get rid of this and send it to Ekron, and in verse 9. It was after they transferred it that the hand of Adonai was set against the city, causing a great commotion. The hemorrhoids struck the people of the city from small to great, and they were afflicted internally with hemorrhoids. They then set the ark of God to Ekron, and that is the same thing there. What's being taught here? This is it. God uses small things in our lives to rob us of our rest, our comfort. Because, you know, one of the commentators said here that, you know, when they had the hemorrhoids, they couldn't sit. They could no longer rest. Took away their comfort. Took away their rest. And then the mice, it tells us later, came through and it ate their crops. Took away their prosperity. But these are small things. You know, I've met so many people, and I've experienced these things spiritually in my life as well, where it seems like I have God's presence in my life, but I am not living the life I should. Because not only do I have God's presence there, I've got my own little Dagon with me. And I don't want to let Dagon go. I want God's presence, but I want Dagon too. And then God sends the discomforts into my life. He sends the pains in the rear. He sends the discomfort. The rest is lost. It seems like no matter how hard I work, no matter how hard I try, it seems like everything just kind of hemorrhages out of my life. The money goes out. The possessions. Everything's kind of deflated. It's like my blimp is full of holes. And yet, people who go through this often will think, well, God, why are you doing this to me? And it's almost like he's saying, it's that Dagon, that doggone Dagon, you know? Get him out or get rid of me. But we're not going to stay here together. One of us has to go. I think probably, if we're honest, every one of us have experienced in the spiritual realm these two small things, unseen things that God sends into our lives to rob us of comfort, to rob us of rest, to rob us of prosperity and accomplishment and success. Not that I have a name it, claim it, where you should all be wealthy and rich and good looking, but it just seems like our work is not productive. The mice are always kind of eating away at everything we produce. And my recommendation is either get rid of Dagon or you have to send God packing. And some of the people I know sent God packing and they're happier now. They're lost. But the mice and the hemorrhoids are gone. They don't have God's victory in their life, but then again, they don't have the pains and all the loss either. Some people send God packing, and they're happier. Because you see, there's nothing more miserable in this world than a person who's half redeemed. There's not a person more miserable than one who wants to compromise. They want God in their life, plus their own idols as well. That is absolute misery. It's intolerable. One or the other has to go. So count the cost. Either be hot or be cold, but being lukewarm is just the pits. Absolutely. Do you know people like that who sent God packing out of their lives? I do. And he left. And they're better now. They're happier now. They're lost. They're not truly happy. At least they're not in the agony that they were at one time. So what did they do? They talk to their wise men and their diviners, and they come up with a really brilliant plan. They said, take two milk cows that have calves, that have never had a yoke on them, put a yoke on them, and make a brand new cart out of wood. And you're going to put the Ark of the Covenant on this cart, and then I want you to make golden hemorrhoids. Now, use your imagination. I have no idea what that looks like. But we want to make one for each of these five cities that were attacked, and then make little golden mice, and put this treasure in another box on the cart next to the Ark, and then just turn the cows loose and see what happens. Because the way they figured is this. They figured cows have never worn a yoke, aren't going to do too well if they're just stuck in a yoke the first time. Because using a yoke, it takes training. You take a new ox and put it next to an experienced ox so the experienced one can teach the young one how to wear the yoke. But two milk cows, if they're ready to yoke, they're not going to get along. And also, if they're nursing, they have young calves, they're not going to leave those calves. And it says specifically, put the calves behind them. And the third thing is, if they head straight to Israel, straight to the place where the Jews live, then obviously it is the God of Israel who is guiding them. Because these are unnatural things for two milk cows to do. And yet this is exactly what the milk cows did. They set a straight line to Beth Shemesh. And off they went, mooing, lowing as they went. Left their young behind, walked with this yoke on them in a beeline, and just headed straight back. And the Philistines watch us and realize, okay, the hemorrhoids and the mice, that wasn't coincidence. It really was the God of Israel. It really was him who was doing this. So we're better off to send this ark back to them. You know, this is a beautiful picture of the story of Yeshua. Did you catch it when you read this? Yeshua is the unseen character in much of the Bible. Because these two milk cows, these two sources of milk, and what is the sincere milk of the Word? Who is the author of that? Who does that come from? That's from Yeshua. Desire the sincere milk of the Word, we're commanded. Well, where does this milk come from? Who provides this living drink for us? It's Yeshua. It's a picture. It's a picture again. Why two? Because there's a dual nature here. Human, divine. Also, probably the ark, justice and also grace and mercy. And he wears a yoke. And so he goes, and where does he go to? Beth Shemesh. Beth Shemesh means house of the sun. Shemesh means the sun. Who's the light of the world? All right? Who's the light that came to this world? These cows go straight to the field, the house of the sun, and into this field. And who owns the field? You remember the name of the person who owns the field? Joshua, which is the same name as Yeshua. And there are Levites in this field because Beth Shemesh is a Levitical city. So what do they do? Now, get the picture. The ark is on this cart, and the presence of God is being brought to the field of the sun, the field of Yeshua, the house of the sun, by these two cows. Just as Yeshua brings the presence of God into the field where the house of light, the sun is, the field of Yeshua. He brings it in. And then what did they do with the ark? It became the altar. It became the fuel to destroy the cows. Yeshua carried his own cross. He carried his own wooden cross, and on that cross he gave his life. These two cows pulled this wooden cart, and on this cart they gave their lives at this rock. And now what's interesting, did you catch what they named this rock? Let's pick it up. In verse 17, we're in chapter 6, verse 17. Or verse 18, we'll pick it up there. And golden mice corresponded to the number of all the Philistine cities of the five governors who ruled from fortified city until the open village until the great morning. As referring to the sun, the stone, the great morning stone. Not morning as in a.m., but morning as in mourning a loss, mourning a death. This rock came to be known as the great morning stone. And the place where Yeshua was crucified has been a place of great mourning. And the people there, this stone, were not wise. And they weren't righteous. Because they looked into the ark and they died. The ark was always to be covered. Always to be covered. And here it was. They looked at it and they looked in it. They desecrated it and it cost them their lives. And we know that, you know, Yeshua wept over Jerusalem as he was riding into it. And he said, oh, if you'd only known this day, the day of your visitation. And he talked about how he would have gathered them under his wings like a hen gathers her chicks. But what did he say? Now it's going to be left to you desolate. And he prophesied to his disciples about how not one stone be left on the other. And great desolation came. You see the picture here? And then where did the ark go from there? This is the killer. Where did the ark go from there? Like the Philistines, they say, we got to get this ark out of here. It's killing us. So where does it go? Look at the last verse. The last verse of the chapter. They then sent emissaries to the inhabitants of Kiriath Jearim, saying, the Philistines have returned the ark of Adonai. Come down and bring it up unto yourselves. And then verse 1 of chapter 7. So the men of Kiriath Jearim came and brought up the ark of Adonai. And they brought it to the house of Abinadab on the hill, and they designated Eleazar his son to guard the ark of Adonai. Do you know where Kiriath Jearim is? The scripture will tell us later. It's in Gibeon. It's a town of Gentiles. The Gibeonites. Remember the Gibeonites? God told Joshua when he came into the land, I don't want you making any covenants with any people of the land. So what do the Gibeonites do? They act like they're from way off somewhere and they have moldy food and worn clothes and they're all dilapidated and they come, we've come to this far country, you know, and will you make a pet? Please don't kill us. And Josh says, okay, I promise I won't kill you. Oh, good, because we're really not from a far country. We live right up here. The Gibeonites, the Gentiles, and that's where the ark rested for many years and brought tremendous blessing to the house of Benadab, to that town. And all the people there. What an incredible forepicturing of what's going to happen, you know? Yes, Jim.
In the
The cry was so great that when it's an idiom when they say the outcry went up to heaven. In fact, you put your finger on one of the descriptors here that is the same as what we find back in the story of the Exodus. I mean, think of the parallels here. A lot of the language is the same as you find about Egypt. We find that God brings great plagues in Egypt. He brings plagues here. The people's cry ascends to heaven. Same thing happened in Egypt. And the people who wanted to hold on to the ark at first now want it out, just like the Egyptians wanted to hold on to Israel, to the Jews, and now get rid of them. And when they sent them out with treasure. And so the ark returns to the land with tremendous wealth. You see? So there's this parallel. And one of the beautiful parallels here is that you would think that Israel would have been exiled from the land for their sin under Hophni and Phinehas. But instead, God exiles himself. He allows himself to be exiled in their place. It's a beautiful picture of how God, even though the people in Israel deserve to be exiled, he allowed himself to go into exile. And then he returns to them with great wealth. But then they exile him again. They said, no, get out of here. Go up to Gibeon. There's an interesting passage I came across in a book that I want to share with you. And any questions you have, any questions or comments, please. This one pastor, I think he lives out in California. He said, act like a Philistine and you can expect to be punished like a Philistine. He's talking about the 50,000 Israelites who died when they opened the ark. Act like a Philistine and you can expect to be punished like a Philistine. After committing sacrilege, the people of Beth Shemesh acted like Philistines again by trying to get rid of the ark. Instead of repenting of their sins, they sent the ark out of their country, like the men who urged Jesus to leave them after he killed their swine. Who is able to stand before Adonai, this holy God, they asked. Certainly not Dagon, certainly not Philistines, and certainly not Israelites, who act no better than worshippers of Dagon. The Lord fights Philistines wherever they are. You know, we can have God's presence in our lives and still act like Philistines and suffer because of it. Or we can be like the house of Abinadab, have God's presence in our lives, but because we fear him and love him, and we live holy lives in obedience to him, we are filled with tremendous blessing. So people say, oh, I've accepted God in my heart. I'm not impressed. Philistines accepted God into their temple, put him right there next to Dagon. And nothing but misery. My question is, do you love him? You know, when I accepted God in my life, it was because I was just sick of life as it was. I wanted to escape. I didn't want to go to hell. I was just miserable. I'd done things my way. I didn't like it. It's like, God, just rescue me. I didn't love him yet. I didn't really know him yet. I just wanted relief. But as I've come to know him and love him, blessing has begun to come into my life. Again, I'd rather have one person who fears God and really loves him than have 100 who can brag on his power. Get the picture? Okay. Any other questions or comments? You've been so quiet tonight. Passover hangover. I know what you're all doing. You're waiting for the sun to go down, so you're all rush out and buy a loaf of bread. Well, if there are no questions or comments, we'll just close in prayer. Father, thank you so much for your word. It's so precious. It's so full and rich. And I pray you give us eyes to look deeply into it, to drink from it, the sincere milk of your word. And I pray, Father, that not only will we have you in our lives and have your presence in our lives, but Lord, you'd be at home in our lives. Because you'd find there a warm welcome, a loving heart of people who are dedicated to you, who stand in awe of you, who respect you and love you. Lord, I pray that you would find a home. And Lord, if there are little things kind of eating away at us all the time, the small things that maybe no one else sees, but Lord, we feel them and we feel the discomfort and we sense the constant loss, then Father, I pray, we would not be like the Philistines who'd rather lose you than their own idols. But Father, we would chuck our own idols out and be done with them. And we would recognize you as not our God, but our only God. So make us the people you want us to be. Make us seekers of truth, lovers of truth. And Lord, I pray that your ark would dwell in our lives in righteousness and justice and in grace and mercy. That we can walk in that perfect balance. And as a result, the Shekinah light of your glory would be our light. And we would be lights in this dark world. And people would see our good works and not give glory to us, but they would see a deeper source. They would give glory to you, our Father in heaven. Make us that kind of person. We ask in Yeshua's precious and perfect name. Amen.